It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As a 19-year-old, Therese Rocco was supposed to be a temporary replacement in the missing persons office, but she wound up with a highly decorated career spanning more than four decades. She discusses the road to her highest post, Pittsburgh's first female assistant police chief, in her self-titled memoir. I spoke to her just after its release. It's one of my favorite Confluence conversations. We hope it's one of yours, too. Here's Therese from her home in Brookline. I asked her why the missing persons unit in the 1940s was staffed entirely by women.
Well, because it was considered a very insignificant problem. Runaway children, and men did not feel that they should be involved in such an insignificant problem. So the women were assigned to the missing persons. And most of our cases were small children who walked away from home. Unfortunately, children who were abandoned, children who were cast away, which of course today we are faced with that problem, but it was more insurmountable in those years.
So the good news is you were able to get that job immediately because you didn't have to get training at the police academy. The bad news is you and the other women at the time did not receive academy training.
Absolutely not. We were just considered, women, and most of them looked at us in terms of, you know, we need a cake for a celebration. But I was not one of those gals.
How did that affect your frame of mind, even your ability to do the job, that being shut out of getting that training?
I was very fortunate to meet a woman who was in charge. She was second in command, but I have to thank her because she took me under her wing. She was very competent, no education, but she knew her stuff, and I hung on to her.
You write, for some, maybe many, the idea of an armed, uniformed woman in the field was preposterous.
Oh, yes. That was unbelievable. In fact, it was suggested later in years, and the superintendent of police at the time says, we couldn't do that. We'd put guns in these women's hands. They'd have an argument. They would kill each other. This is the way they looked at us.
One of your duties was to be a decoy, to act as bait. So you were unarmed. You had no self-defense training, but you were often put in harm's way. What was that like?
Perhaps because of my youth, I didn't consider the danger. I was brave. I thought I could do it. You know, I would be shaking in my boots, you know, but I did it. It didn't seem too much.
Well, one example that you write about in your memoir, you were bait for a man who was molesting women in a downtown movie theater. This turns out you actually infuriated your partner in this case. Why so?
You know, when I first heard a decoy, I didn't even know what the word meant. And you're going to be somebody that you're not. You're going to act. And he explained that this was a predator who molested women in this theater, and it was going on quite frequently. So the gentleman who I was with, the detective, Iggy Burkowski, we worked quite a bit and taught me a lot on the street. He told me that you go up front, you sit there, the minute he makes a move on you, lift the hand. But I was so infuriated. He leaned over and he grabbed my leg and he was pushing it over. All I could think of, what a nerve this guy has. He got up and ran and I chased him.
But here you are, unarmed, chasing a guy who could have been armed.
Yeah, he could have turned around and cracked me. And then I saw Iggy running and I ran and I grabbed the guy. He fell and I pulled down his pants.
You stopped him.
I stopped him. That's what I said to him. He went, ooh. He was so upset with me. And I said, oh, detective. I said, we got him. We got him.
You eventually made a name for yourself and the department within the Bureau, across the region, even nationwide, for your dogged, effective work in locating missing children. What about that particular work fueled you?
I loved it. I just got into it so deeply. These kids became my kids. And I'd never hesitated to give them my phone number at home if I thought I could help them. In my career, I do remember many, many children that I got put on the right path. And I think that's the greatest joy I feel today, knowing that I could go somewhere and somebody could come up to me and say, "Do you remember me?" But of course, when they talk about the situation, I do. And they say, "Thank you." And you know, that's a great feeling.
Not all the cases ended happily. One case especially really affected you. June 7th, 1962, 10-year-old Marianne Verdecchia disappeared from her Bloomfield neighborhood. The entire police department paid attention. You write you never felt greater anxiety, scrutiny of the media, fears of the neighborhood. Why so?
I think because of the situation that that child was involved in. She came from parents. The mother had taken off when she was only 5 years old. The father was an alcoholic. An aunt who I admired and liked very, very much was raising her. And Marianne was a lonely child. And I could envision this little girl going from place to place trying to get affection and attention. And she just became a part of my life. And to this day, I'm holding on to that case. We know who did it, but we can't prove it.
So more than 50 years later, the case is still technically open. Do you believe it will get solved? And you said you know who did it. You haven't been able to prove it yet. Do you think it is still possible?
I absolutely do, because I'm on it. I'm not letting it go.
I believe you were on the job about a dozen years or so when you and other women in the department finally started getting academy training. Did that change how you approached the job at all?
Well, fortunately, we became under the direction of a gentleman named Gene Kuhn. And till this day, I have to give this man credit. As soon as he became the assistant chief of police, he called me in, and I sat there. And I gave him a total, complete rundown of how discriminated we were. He says, "Why aren't you people coming to the meetings in the morning?" We were never allowed to. I mean, it was unbelievable. He changed all that.
Of course, Gene Kuhn went on to become Allegheny County Sheriff for many years. Yeah. You were eventually made captain. Some might think, hey, that's not too bad. But you were getting paid, as you write, the equivalent of a lower-ranked sergeant. Many other women in your department were getting paid even less than that. There was a class action discrimination suit for equal pay. You weren't part of that suit, but you testified for the plaintiffs. Did the court decision help the overall picture for women officers?
Absolutely. I testified 2 days, and I read reports of what these women accomplished. I described how they were discriminated for many years, how they were underpaid. They won the case. And I had no idea that I was being considered part of that case. And I thought, well, I don't care. You know, I didn't sue. I never sued. I never complained. And before the case was decided by this judge, they came to me and they offered me equal pay. And I said, "What about the women?" "Oh, you're not part of that." I didn't sign immediately, and I thought about it. And I consulted a friend who was an attorney, and he said, "Sign it and get the money." On his advice, I did it, which was bad advice.
Because you didn't get back pay.
I didn't get back pay, which was almost $21,000 or $26,000.
How much did becoming Pittsburgh's first female assistant police chief feel important at the time? And the second part of that is, how important was it that Pittsburgh's first and still only woman mayor, Sophie Maslov, administering the oath mean to you?
Well, Sophie was a wonderful mayor. She was down to earth. She was not absorbed in herself. She was very much like myself. We were concerned about people, and that's the way Sophie was. And Sophie and Rita Kane, they befriended me, and they treated me wonderful. So Rita said to Sophie, "Sophie, we have to do something for this woman because the men are not going to do it." And it was Sophie who eventually appointed me assistant chief.
the Bureau's Missing Persons Department still includes quite a few female officers, investigators. All of them, of course, have received academy training equal to their male colleagues. What hopes do you have for that department, that office, for the women working there and in the coming years?
Well, I believe that Missing Persons Bureau is probably the most important of all investigative units because it involved everything. It involved everything. We were the people who encountered a child. We questioned that child. We could go to a person in the burglary, in the robbery, and in the homicide and give them more information than they could have got from anyone. And this is what we were doing. And I'm not bragging, but I think that I was able to cultivate this in departments all over the county.
Final question. So what advice would you give to young women today considering police work or who have just begun police work?
I would consider any young woman accepting any assignment that she's given. Don't walk into a police department and say, oh, I don't think I'm going to like doing that. You're going to love it. No matter where you begin, no matter what you do, it's a learning process. It's something that cultivates your knowledge and entitles you to learn everything there is to know, more than your male, because they're determined, they're men that we're going to do a man's job. But most of the things that we do are not all a man's job.
The memoir is Therese Rocco, Pittsburgh's first female assistant police chief. Therese Rocco, thanks so much for talking with us, and thanks for your decades of service to Pittsburghers.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk about my experiences because they've never left my heart. And I am here for anyone who needs help today. Knock on my door.
That's retired Detective Therese Rocco talking last year about her self-titled memoir, Therese Rocco, Pittsburgh's First Female Assistant Police Chief. A one-woman play about her life titled The Epitome of Grace will premiere at the Bricolage Theater in Pittsburgh April 3rd, 4th, and 5th. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Throughout the history of recorded music, there have been many songs that kinda sound like other songs. 5 years ago today, the estate of the late Marvin Gaye was awarded $7.3 million because a jury found that Robin Thicke's hit song Blurred Lines sounded kinda like Gaye's Got to Give It Up. Thicke and his co-writer Pharrell Williams argued that while they have a similar vibe, musically they're very different. Songwriters like Stevie Wonder spoke out against the judgment, saying that just about any new song will contain elements of something released before it. Could you tell when one song ended and the other began? For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Nenna Cherry. Growing up in her native Sweden, Nenna Cherry was exposed to music at an early age. Her stepfather was jazz trumpeter Don Cherry. Her big break came in 1989 with the release of her debut album, Raw Like Sushi, and its smash hit, Buffalo Stance.
We always hang in a buffalo stance. We do the dive at the time we dance.
She released two albums in the 1990s, and one of them featured her global hit, 7 Seconds, a duet with Senegalese musician Youssou N'Dour.
It's not a second, we're 7 seconds away.
She took more than a decade off before recording any more albums, but in the interim remained busy caring for her family and collaborating with artists like Massive Attack, The Judds, Pulp, Gorillaz, and Lenny Kravitz. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last month, the Environmental Protection Agency proposed regulating some PFAS chemicals in drinking water. These are also known as forever chemicals because they're so hard to clean up. Many Pittsburghers aren't quite sure what PFAS chemicals are or what they do.
Doesn't sound nice, so I'm guessing it's something harmful, some sort of harmful chemical.
I'm really not sure. I haven't heard anything about it.
It doesn't sound good. Doesn't sound healthy, but I don't even know that I could guess.
Those were Derek Blaze of the Southside and Rachel Jakelski and Jeff Petsis of Oakland. As part of our occasional series, A Moment of Science, 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis spoke with University of Pittsburgh professor and PFAS researcher Carla Ng.
PFAS are kind of an acronym soup. The name itself stands for per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances, which sounds really complicated, and they sort of are, but in general, they're what we think of as non-stick chemicals. We think that there are on the order of 5,000 different PFAS that have been developed, and probably 3,000 in active use. They're applied to surfaces and products in order to repel both oil and water. So your nonstick pans, they were also used for surface treatments of fabrics and carpets and upholstery. So Scotchgard, people are familiar with that. They've also been used in large quantities in these specialized firefighting foams that were meant to fight fuel fire. So if you have oil that catches fire, and that's one of the main ways that they've been released in large quantities into the environment. For some of these chemicals, they are a bioaccumulative, which means that they build up in our bodies. They're linked to certain cancers, including kidney cancer and testicular cancer. They're linked to liver health effects and to some developmental effects. One of the concerning effects when you think about children is that they are immune suppressants, and so they reduce the efficacy of vaccines. For many other PFAS, there are very few data available, so this is an active area of research. The fact that these chemicals are extremely persistent, they never break down in the environment naturally, means that once you emit them, they're really difficult to clean up, and when we do find a toxic impact, then we're stuck with a huge cleanup bill. We know how to remove some of these. For example, for the long chain ones, we can use granular activated carbon to absorb them from the water, but then you have to do something with that carbon that has accumulated all these PFAS. And one of the best known ways to do this is through incineration, but there are concerns that if you don't do it properly, that's just going to wind up emitting the chemicals to the air. The other area of super active research at the moment is trying to find a way to biodegrade them, so using microbes to chew them up. And there are some promising new technologies that seem to be able to do that. However, many of the efforts I've seen basically take a long-chain PFAS and convert it to a shorter-chain PFAS. And the shorter ones are the ones that are more mobile, more water-soluble, and are much harder to remove from our drinking water. Because of the magnitude of the contamination issue, this is sort of an all-hands-on-deck opportunity and need for more research and really trying to find inventive new ways to remove these chemicals.
That story was produced by WESA tech reporter Kathleen Davis. Find more stories from our Moment of Science series on our website, WESA.fm. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Words like outsiders, aliens, and undesirables have dominated political discourse in the Trump era. But these conversations don't always involve immigration at the southern border. Sometimes it's the people next door. As part of the Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 series, reporter Max Marin takes us to the Bridesburg neighborhood of Philadelphia, where homeowners have been trying to build a wall against renters.
The first thing people in Bridesburg tell visitors is not to tell anyone else about Bridesburg. They're only half joking.
I really don't want to do this interview because Bridesburg is a truly hidden gem, and we don't want to tell many people about it. We want to keep it to ourselves.
That's Joe Slabinski III. His family funeral home has been in the neighborhood for over 100 years. His grandfather, his father, his mother, his wife, his kids, they're all funeral directors. Bridesburg is that kind of multi-generational place. the kind that takes pride in its old-school outlook.
They say you're not supposed to hug them. If they cry, you're not supposed to wipe their butts.
Jacqueline DeSanctis, who people only know as Miss Jackie, has worked in the neighborhood rec center for 60 years.
Well, we just tell them up front, if a three-year-old's crying, we're going to hug them.
Bridesburg is a sleepy pocket of row homes along the Delaware River in Philly. Only a few roads take you in and out, giving it the feel of an urban cul-de-sac. This quarter once bustled with German and Irish immigrants who could walk to jobs in nearby factories, a place where your last name got you in the club for life.
The Hewitts, they were huge. The Halks.
The Minches. The families that were here were so big,
kind of took up the entire neighborhood.
We're at a meeting with a group called Stars and Stripes Bars and Pipes, which does charity for veterans and first responders. Leader Yvonne Stevens says even as some things changed in the Berg, much stayed the same.
I mean, I always use that phrase, and I always say it all the time. We don't mind living like Mayberry.
Yvonne grew up in the neighborhood in the 1970s. And as we walked down her old street, she said every day used to feel like a block party.
We would play constantly from morning to night. Imagine kids doing that.
Right in this little side street?
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Morning to night.
She moved out of the neighborhood for a while in her 20s and came back in her 30s with the kids. The neighborhood is still small, quiet, and family-oriented. In a city drowning with 300 homicides a year, Bridesburg is a working-class safe haven that very rarely makes the police blotter. As leader of the Bridesburg Civic Association, Yvonne fights tooth and nail to keep it that way.
We don't want to build up. We want to stay like we are, but we want to continue building a little, but not to where we're bringing so much crazy into our neighborhood, because we don't need so much crazy.
Bridesburg, though, seems to be at a crossroads. Local leaders want more small business and investment, but they're also resistant to change. Can progress come without opening up to newcomers? Here, a lot seems to depend on this question. Are you a homeowner or a renter? Here's Yvonne and her friends.
I think we have a lot of rentals around here.
Yeah, right? We have more rentals now than you guys since we've been growing up, basically.
I remember as a kid hanging over here. You couldn't get in this neighborhood if you tried, and now it's like the block behind me has six houses of rentals, and they're holes.
It's hard to talk about renting in Bridesburg without mentioning race. Bridesburg is over 90% white and has been slow to diversify. The neighborhood also has a long history of racial discrimination, but today its gatekeepers say that's not why they push back on rentals. They say it's to keep the neighborhood's family-first vibe going for generations to come. Yvonne's kids are now 17 and 27.
Even when we moved out and came back, you know, my daughter would still come down here and hang out with her friends. It's family. It's family. It really is.
One of their biggest fears with renters is out-of-town landlords, who they claim have ruined other nearby neighborhoods. Again, Joe Slabinski.
You know, if you have a block with 20 homes, 15 of them are rental units. The owner is not there. The owners are New York or out somewhere, and they're not there. So no pride, rentals.
Politically, registered Democrats dominate the neighborhood. But in 2016, they voted en masse for Republican Donald Trump. It's not hard to see why a Make America Great Again slogan would resonate here. Bridesburg's leaders have been largely successful in building a wall around their neighborhood. Most residents here are still homeowners, and leaders have kept it that way by using the zoning code to squash apartments and duplexes, also by passing homes down to family and friends, and by asking homeowners who want to rent their property to think twice.
Well, when they moved in, they could not rent.
Right.
In Bryan.
They're not allowed
to rent. They had to sell. That was the rule when they moved there.
If you're part of the old guard, this is great news. But if you're a family that sees value in Bridesburg and wants to come in and snag a rental, you're pretty much out of luck, especially if you want to use a subsidized housing voucher. Again, Slabinski.
I don't even want to bring this other word up, never mind, because we're being taped, Section 8. I don't think there's any in Philadelphia, in Bridesburg right now.
Federal housing data shows that about a third of Philadelphia's census tracts don't contain a single resident using a voucher. Landlords technically can't discriminate based on vouchers, but the practice is common across the country.
Calling about an ad I saw for an apartment on Craigslist in Bridesburg.
Every property manager I got in touch with told me the same thing.
It doesn't say on the ad, but do you take housing vouchers?
No, I'm sorry.
you dig deeper into housing issues in Bridesburg, though, things are a lot more complicated than the homeowner versus renter dichotomy. Joe Slabinski is actually a landlord in the neighborhood himself, and Yvonne, the champion of homeownership.
I rent my house.
You rent your house?
Yeah, I rent my house.
You're one of the rental permits?
Yeah, I rent my house.
But some homeowners themselves feel unwelcome, especially people of color like Yali Perez. 7 years after buying in the Berg, she's still wary about racial tensions exploding into the streets.
The kids will come out and play or whatever, and next thing you know, one of the kids say something that's racist, and next thing you know, the parents are fighting each other, and so just to avoid it, I'm like, don't go outside.
We'll have more from her perspective on the neighborhood in the next installment of our series. In Bridesburg, I'm Max Marin.
Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 Project is election year coverage that puts people, not politicians, at the center. You can find more at whyy.org/embedded2020. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are no confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the Pittsburgh area yet, but the State Department of Health says we have 10 presumptive cases elsewhere in Pennsylvania. So what does that mean? Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter, and she's here to explain. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
Our state and local health departments are using the word presumptive and presumed, not confirmed. Why?
That's because the CDC is the agency, the federal agency that has to confirm not only the cases out of Pennsylvania, but the entire country. I believe, according to PA Department of Health Secretary Rachel Levine, there have yet to be any cases that were tested positive at the state level that weren't confirmed by the CDC. But that's the sort of method of how we get a confirmed positive. So when we say presume positive, like, there's a very, 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 very high chance that they will be confirmed positive.
So the state lab has received the equipment necessary to do the testing, but the CDC is the one that says for sure it's confirmed.
Exactly.
Okay. Remind us where these presumptive cases are.
Seven are in Montgomery County, one in Delaware, one in Wayne, and one in Monroe.
Are state health officials saying anything about any of these 10, how they contracted it?
Yeah, so I know some are travel related. The fact that they're in the southeastern part of the state, Secretary Levine says that that's probably just because more people live in the southeastern part of the state and doesn't really have anything else to do. Like, that's epidemiologically why. And we got an email or a press release, media did, from the County Department of Health saying that they're expecting coronavirus cases confirmed or presumed positive cases here in the county in the coming days or weeks.
We know that going to the doctor can be expensive. This is a new virus. What have you learned about insurance and whether those tests are going to be covered?
Not only Highmark and UPMC, but the state is saying that all major insurance providers, health insurance providers in Pennsylvania, are covering the cost of testing. Mm-hmm. So,
federal officials have acknowledged a shortage of test kits. You reported that UPMC is developing an in-house coronavirus tests. What does that involve?
So this test is going to be, they're saying, parallel, so very similar to the CDC test. And they can do this through a special waiver that allows physicians, scientists to use non-approved equipment or approved equipment but not approved for those purposes to create diagnostic tests during an emergency. So this is very representative of where we're at right now with testing.
Use the word developing. Do we know when this test might be ready?
I was at a press conference yesterday at UPMC, and all the reporters there were very curious about that, and they were unable to give a timeline, maybe 2 weeks, maybe a month. They're working on it, they say, but we don't know.
So if you have flu-like symptoms, should you just show up at the doctor's office, the ER, what?
Please don't do that. Do not do that. Call first. Call before you go to urgent care, ER, your doctor's office. Say, hey, I have flu-like symptoms. I'm going to come in. So they'll be able to prepare. So they'll be able to make sure that if you have not only coronavirus, but any sort of contagious sort of illness, that you'll be able to stay away from other people so you don't spread your germs.
We have heard from reporting around the world, as well as from the West Coast of the U.S., that many of those afflicted are elderly. Again, so far, children don't seem to be affected. Mm-hmm. Are there any additional precautions being taken about protecting our more vulnerable population?
Yeah, so Dr. David Nance, who is the head of UPMC Senior Communities, said yesterday, if you're sick, even with very mild symptoms, don't go to these communities. Don't go to skilled nursing facilities, which frankly, that is really has always been the rule. He's just really emphasizing that.
Are there any local advisories at this time about, you know, avoiding mass meetings, whether they're sporting events, conventions, schools? The St. Patrick's Day Parade here in Pittsburgh is scheduled for this weekend.
I'm told the St. Patrick's Day Parade is still on. The Secretary of Health, Rachel Levine, says that right now she's not canceling social gatherings. So, but that could change. But right now, parade's on, you know. But if you're sick, stay home.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Thanks so much for your good work, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
Listeners, you can find a live blog on our website at WESA.FM with all the latest developments on the coronavirus in Pennsylvania. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find us online anytime at WESA.FM/confluence. This and every episode of the program is available via podcast. Download, rate, and review us wherever you tune in. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.